It's the Burt Cohen Show. History does swing quite a bit, doesn't it? I mean, look at the whole gay issue. Just a few years ago, everybody was against gay marriage. Now everybody's for it. And when it comes to public utilities, there's been a heck of a lot of change about what the best way to do it is. There's been a swing even by Republicans who want to take back what had become private utilities, such as water and electricity, things that are regulated in the public interest, take them back, sometimes municipalize them, have publicly owned. And, you know, it brings up the question of who does the government serve? Who should the economy serve? And there's a lot going on in that. You probably haven't thought about it very much, but history does have its swings. A few decades ago, it was all the rage to privatize public utilities. Now it seems to be swinging back. And our guest today, Matt Iglesias, has written about it, writes for Slate magazine. And I wonder if you could first basically just define what a utility is, Matt.
Well, sure. A utility is something like an electrical company or a water company, in some places, maybe a transportation, you know, a subway, something like that. And it refers to certain kinds of physical infrastructure services where you don't really have a competitive market in them because it would be extremely expensive and sort of pointless to have a bunch of overlapping power grids serving, you know, a given county or a given city. So you really just have the one set of power lines. Somebody owns them. It has to be run one way or another. And it's one of the trickiest questions in economic policy is really what's the right thing to do about those kind of utilities.
And I'm sure that maybe there's, I'm guessing that there's no one right answer. What the right thing to do is, it must vary from place to place and from utility to utility. I wonder if you could describe some of the various forms of ownership and control of utilities. I mean, many states, for example, have private electric companies that are generally pretty profitable, and they're regulated to some degree to serve the public interest because the public doesn't really have a choice. We got to use the electric company. So I wonder what some of the various forms of ownership and control are that you know of, Matt.
Right. So one classic way to do it is to simply, you know, let private companies build these things and then say, well, because it's a monopoly, we need to regulate it. And so what you typically have then is, in order to sort of change the electricity rate, say, you have to go to a utility commission and say, oh, you know, we want to charge more money. And then the commission is supposed to look at that and say, well, look, you know, what kind of return on investment do you want to make? Because you don't want to let the utility gouge the customers and just make windfall profits, but you also don't want the utility to have zero profits because they need to have an incentive to invest money in maintaining the infrastructure, keeping it up to date, using the latest technologies, doing repairs, things like that. So that's sort of a textbook idea, is that, you know, when you have a natural monopoly, you need to have a regulated utility and you set up a commission of specialists. Another idea, though, is that the government could just do it for themselves, the way in big cities, typically, the government doesn't regulate the subway operator. It just, you know, owns and operates it directly. And in some parts of America, electrical utilities and municipal water systems are often done that way. A third thing is that you can have what's called co-ops, where it's a private entity, but it's a nonprofit entity. And that's sort of very typically done in rural areas in lots of parts of the country, although then the co-ops often subcontract to private utilities in order to run it. So there's a sort of a complicated range of institutional arrangements, but the idea in all cases is that you need to sort of restrain the profit-seeking mentality that the utility is going to have.
Well, it does seem that the principle, the organizing principle for most making money activities is making money. But profit is not always in the best interests of that old notion of the common good. I wonder about balancing, how difficult it is in the case specifically of a regulated utility, the balancing act between the interests of the private profitability and serving the public good. How do they often do that balancing act? I would think that, you know, the bottom line tends to be the bottom line for private utilities. I wonder about the overhead costs and the management and waste. People are always concerned about waste and management, and that's why people are concerned about, say, government involvement in what could be called the public utility of the health delivery system. What's your knowledge of cost overheads and efficiency in running it between, you know, public and private? Is it always more efficient to do it private, or what do you know, Matt?
Well, the reason that many places moved toward a private model was this idea that, yes, that there was too much waste, that a publicly owned utility is supposed to report its costs and then set rates that are according to the costs. But the problem with that, people thought, was that, well, so the public utility doesn't really have an incentive to keep costs down. Right, that, you know, in theory, the politicians might appoint the best possible people to run it. They'll do a great job. They'll save the public a lot of money. But in practice, you know, the people who are going to pay a lot of attention to the utility are maybe the labor unions that represent the workforce or subcontractors that they work with. So the costs will go up, and then you just sort of automatically have the right to bill the public for whatever it costs. So the thought was, you know, you shift it to a private operator, and he's going to find ways to sort of wring the costs out of the system, get costs as low as possible. He's going to get some of the profits, but then some of that saving is passed on to the customers. The problem in that case turns out to be that really a different version of the same issue arises, that the question becomes, you know, who do you appoint to your public utility commission? How do you regulate this entity? And you need people with some industry expertise, and the industry itself has a lot of incentive to spend time lobbying on this, contributing to people's campaigns.
Oh, yeah.
So the tendency is you get a utility regulator. You know, you get a sort of a foxes guarding the hen house dynamic, where instead of, you know, taking a tough look and making sure that savings are passed on to the public, you get very soft regulators, and the company tends to, so our local electrical utility where I live, it spends a lot of money on, you know, kind of weird kinds of advertising. They do some good stuff. They donate to some civic groups, but that's sort of part of building a political support for
exactly.
A coalition behind Pepco to let them charge a lot, and then they often end up underinvesting in maintenance and infrastructure, because if a storm comes and it breaks, you know, and their reserve fund is out of money, well, you know, then they get to increase rates because you're not going to not repair the power grid.
Yeah, it is amazing. I think that's probably pretty darn universal that privately owned public utilities spend a heck of a lot of money saying how generous they are, how good for the community they are. They really need to do that. They're not exactly shrinking violets about the contributions.
Right. And, you know, you don't want to say that giving to charity
and
civic organizations is a bad thing, but it should always make you suspicious. I mean, any private company is out there to make money.
Of course.
And if they seem to be spending so much time talking about their kind of civic work in the community,
right.
You know, you do have to wonder, why are they doing that? And often it's to undermine the regulation.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a general feeling where this radio station comes from is that, the utility, you know, they do nice things, but their rates are too high. Their rates are too high. They pushed ahead with a nuclear power plant despite tremendous opposition from the public, from the people who live there. And of course, it's remarkably not profitable for them now, for sure. We're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Matt Iglesias, writer for Slate Magazine, about public utilities. What might the future be? There was an interesting situation in the city of Nashua, New Hampshire, where a few years ago, it was Republican sponsored. I was in the state Senate at the time. There was a Penichuk Water Company, a private water company, and leading the charge to take them over by eminent domain were Republicans.
Mm.
And I thought this was fascinating, but I just kind of laid back and let it all happen because, it wasn't working particularly well. It wasn't serving the people. Everybody needs water. Everybody needs electricity. But I wonder about the efficiency issue. Private ownership is allegedly makes things more efficient. But I wonder about what you know about overhead. They have to pay. I mean, the electric company here in New Hampshire is the biggest political power in the state of New Hampshire, bar none. And you don't mess with them. I mean, sometimes you do, but generally they win because they're the big boys on the block. But they get paid a lot of good money to lobby and to keep their tremendous political power. What about this overhead? Is the public being, government workers, public servants, are they always more efficient, have less overhead? Or what do we know at this point in our history?
Well, one thing is that a private company has a lot of extra costs that a publicly owned utility isn't going to have. That a private utility is going to pay its executives more than a public utility is going to.
Sure.
A private utility has to, it has to charge customers an operational surplus, not only to sort of cover its basic infrastructure needs, but to give its shareholders a return on investment. So it needs to pay out dividends in a way that a public utility doesn't. For a public utility, that's just a kind of a rainy day fund. And it also winds up spending a lot of money on lobbying, public relations, advertising, that kind of thing to help build support for its agenda for the relatively high salaries that its executives
make. Mm-hmm.
Against that, you have to weigh this possibility of waste and less efficient management of the core enterprise. So you get, I would say, a different kind of waste and excess cost in the different structures. A well-run public utility should be the best solution to the problem.
Well, how does... Interesting. I wonder, I would think that at least it's within the realm of possibility that a publicly owned, publicly controlled utility could have real oversight over how it's run. I mean, there's no reason why they couldn't.
Right, exactly. And particularly if the public in the area is very focused on the question of the utility and utility regulation, it can get very, very good. The problem tends to come in that if you have a public utility and it's been running, not for 1 year, not for 5 years, but for 10, 20, 30 years, over time people stop paying attention, small problems mount up, and they get worse and worse and worse. And this is one reason why we had a lot of switching several decades ago, and now we're having a lot of switching in the other direction, which is that either system can accumulate problems over time, and it looks very appealing to switch, but nothing lasts forever unless people are really focused on the question and trying to do the best possible job.
Yeah, and it's true. People, when they think of electricity, they turn on the switch, beginning and end. They don't think about it very much more, but water is a big part of that. Somebody brought up the something called the Big Dig in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the Southeast Expressway there.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with it.
And it was a private utility running the thing. It was a private contracting system. The projected cost originally was about $3 billion. Now it's about $18 billion and may never be done. The tunnels leak. Tiles have fallen from the ceiling and killed at least one person. I wonder how the city of Boston, for example, feels about that. Would anyone say this was a good way to do it?
No, I don't think that anybody does. At the same time, you're of course going to have some private companies involved in a major project like that. Even if you have the of construction workers directly employed by the state, it's the state of Massachusetts isn't going to start building the equipment that you use to undertake these kind of things. So, I think these debates sometimes get excessively polarized around, should we privatize or should we not? Should we have public utilities or should we have private ones? You always have some mix of both. With a private utility, you have a public regulator. With a public with a public utility, you have some level of private contracting.
Sure.
At any rate, it's definitely a myth that if you somehow just go private, problems melt away.
And I'm sure it's not necessarily the same for public. You mentioned a trend that there is kind of a switching going on. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit. Is there a significant trend toward public ownership of what had been privately owned public utilities?
Yes, and a lot of it has been motivated by environmental considerations, because there's been a lot of, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of interest in climate change and other pollution factors that are involved in the electricity generating process. And so a lot of people in different communities, Colorado is one of the biggest moves in this direction, have had the idea that, you know, if you create a public utility, then it can balance these different kinds of considerations. It can make strategic investments in renewable energy. You were talking, you know, conversely about a sort of a nuclear investment by the private utility in New Hampshire. And so, you know, that becomes sort of another dimension of interest where people can think that shaking up the ownership structure will change the mix of actual electricity production.
Again, we're talking about the future of public utilities, what they are, what's the best way to manage that. And it may seem a little bit, you know, not something to think about every day, but a lot of people are concerned about, okay, who does the government work for? Is this government serving me? There was that song a couple of years ago, the rent's too high. Well, the rates are too high. And you know, we want to have some control of it. When you talk about environmental, it's very, very profitable to build nuclear power plants, largely because they don't have to go out in the open market and pay for insurance. But most people, I think, would really like to get away with that. And there's a lot of concern about how are we going to generate electricity for the future. I mean, it seems like most people are in favor of more and more solar, more and more wind, and more decentralized power structure, you know, talking about electric power. But it isn't really happening as much as people would like to see. I wonder what some of the issues are with that when it comes to, you know, the ownership and control of these electric utilities.
Right. I mean, you know, one question to say is that once you start taking sort of non-economic considerations into account, and you want to talk about the environment, and you want to talk about the longer-term energy strategy for your region, the public model can start to look better because you can just sort of look at a budget and say, you know, what are we spending on generation? What are we spending on new capacity? What kind of new capacity are we buying? And we can assess it directly. You know, regulated models, you can do it too, though. You can pass these kind of you know, renewable standards, and you can make different rules and try to make it work with the private system too, but it becomes a little bit more complicated.
And I would think in telecommunications, for example, it's a little bit different. I mean, each utility is a tad different. It used to be Ma Bell, you know, one big giant utility. Then it was broken up, and there's a lot of competition. I don't know of any public ownership of telecommunications facilities, and there does seem to be, you know, the profit system incentive seems to have helped the public good quite a bit. What's your sense about telecommunications?
Right. I mean, in telecommunications, for a long time, we had the private utility model. You know, there was regulation of AT&T and the Bell system, but it was in the hands of private companies. It was very profitable, and to an extent, you know, AT&T did some good things with those profits. They created Bell Labs,
yes.
And, you know, they did some lobbying and stuff like that, but some of their, it was a kind of a PR effort, but it had some real public benefits. Then we realized that it actually is possible in the telephone and telecommunication space to have some level of competition. It's not a really robust competition, but you have a couple different, you know, companies in most of America who are providing phone and cable television services and things like that.
Yes.
And so we moved to a different kind of model on that. European countries have a lot of experience with public ownership of telecommunication companies, and they've almost all moved off of it.
They've all moved off of the public ownership for the most part?
Yes. You know, France, Italy, you can actually see it in the names of the companies. So there's a German company called Deutsche Telekom, which obviously used to be the state-owned telecommunications
sure.
utility of Germany, but they privatized it. They own T-Mobile in the United States now. They compete with France Telecom, which was the state-owned French utility, also been privatized. And they've brought just more competition into the telecommunications sector there. Even they've done a better job than we have in creating something where you normally have three or four options to choose from.
And in England, if I remember correctly, Margaret Thatcher privatized what had been public ownership of say, I mean, the coal mines and that whole industry. And I wonder if, I know there was a lot of griping from the miners' union, but I wonder how well that's worked, if the people of formerly Great Britain are better off now that they have kind of more private enterprise running their public utilities.
I mean, I think that the British privatization experience has been a mixed bag, that they've done a good job with some of the utilities, some of the power generation in particular, also with the airline. British Airways is a private company now. There's lots of flights in and out of London and other major English cities. They've also had a lot of problems with their privatization of railroads in the United Kingdom, and that I think it got walked back under later Labour governments. And they keep changing their telecommunications policy. They now have some new regulator called Office of Communications. Don't know how it's working out. And, of course, they have the BBC, which is a kind of publicly-owned utility that's sort of celebrated around the world.
Or laughed at, either way.
Right.
What about, I mean, in terms of public utilities, the big ones, Franklin Roosevelt, the Hoover Dam, and the Tennessee Valley Authority, that made a tremendous difference in creating jobs and in the lives of the quality of life of the people for hundreds and hundreds of miles around these projects. That wouldn't, I don't believe, have been profitable, either the Tennessee Valley Authority or the Hoover Dam. So I would think there's an argument for federal, shall we say, stimulus in rebuilding our public utilities.
Right. Well, particularly when technology is new, you know, there's a tendency for the private sector to not want to invest in something that is brand new like that.
True.
People knew that electricity was useful, but, you know, at a time when lots of people didn't have electricity, it wasn't obvious that it was something that everyone needed to have. And so there was a tremendous sort of lack of investment in really building out the infrastructure. And by taking that big step forward and saying, no, the federal government is committed to bringing electricity to all parts of the United States, it not only it did a great benefit for those particular communities, but it was a signal to all other kinds of industries that said, look, soon everyone is going to have electricity, so you should make things that, you know, plug into the wall, right? So we had whole new factories for those appliances. In the modern day, you know, we don't have that particular problem of areas with no electricity.
Right.
But a comparable issue would relate to maybe, say, very high-speed internet access, which exists in only a handful of places in the United States are really at state-of-the-art, and many rural communities are sort of well beyond what's technologically possible.
And it does seem that in terms, again, of electricity, that there's tremendous public will for getting off oil and creating jobs by building wind, solar, whatever, and yet I don't believe it's profitable, and I don't see the government right now. Maybe they got burned with that whole Solyndra thing, but wouldn't it be, it seems like it would be to the public benefit to have public ownership of these things and not wait for them to become profitable. There's got to be some kind of either federal, state, regional involvement in creating these things.
Right, and one theory about public ownership is that consumers would be more willing to pay a slightly higher rate for clean energy if they were had confidence that it was a public utility, right? That a private company could install a bunch of solar panels, a bunch of windmills, and say, you know what, this is going to be a little bit more expensive, but it's much better for the environment, so we need to pass the price on to you, the customer. But you're going to look at that on your bill, and you're going to say, well, you know, do I trust these guys? Do I trust their accounting? You know, do I know what kind of kickbacks they're getting? Whereas if it's a public regulator, you know, you might have a debate in the state legislature, in the county council, town council, that says, you know, should we raise rates and make our system cleaner, or should we stick with the status quo? And then the argument for cleaner energy, you know, it might lose, but it also might win. It has a fighting chance.
And then you would have the public involvement about their own future. What a concept. I'm going to go out a little bit on a limb here and ask about when something becomes a public utility. For example, when I grew up, there were a lot of department stores in competition with one another. Now, there's Walmart. There's basically one. Everybody needs to buy stuff. We want, you know, people to be making stuff and purchasing things and increase demand. I wonder at what point something like Walmart might be considered, dare I say, a public utility and regulated as such so that some of the profit could serve the common good. Your thoughts?
You know, I'm not sure that you would see that with Walmart. I mean, they would say that there's a lot of competition from Amazon and from other online retailers. But, you know, one interesting area where this comes up is Google, which provides kind of, you know, basic search infrastructure for the Internet.
There's no competition. True.
Well, right now, Microsoft does compete with Google in search, but they have very little market share, and they're losing tons and tons of money doing it. So any day now, Microsoft might turn Bing off, in which case Google would essentially be the only, you know, meaningful web search on the Internet. And, you know, people might say, well, look, you know, to run a sort of modern, technologically advanced society, we need to be able to search the Internet. It's not just a private concern, but
right.
It's a company and individual people. And we need to start. I don't think you would have the government try to take search over as a directly run thing, but see it become a regulated area where there's some constraints on how Google can tweak its algorithms, what kinds of information it can use, what kinds of ads it can push. You know, I do think that that's a debate that we're going to see coming out of the Federal Trade Commission and hearing from more people.
Very, very interesting. Well, it's got, I mean, everybody needs, I mean, who doesn't Google? It's just a verb now in our language, and that's a good point, and to have power over our future. Do you know, are there any organizations that are, you know, pushing, taking a proactive stance on making utilities more responsive to the public, even calling for public ownership?
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, you know, environmental groups have tended to be at the forefront of this move lately because they're the ones who sort of have the hot issue that they're working to make progress on. And I think that that's sort of the main place that you've seen it lately.
Well, thank you, Matt Iglesias. Always interesting articles. I don't know how you do it all on Slate. I mean, a heck of a lot of research and always very, very interesting stuff on Slate magazine. Matt Iglesias, thanks so much for providing very helpful information about power for the people. Thank you. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Bring power to the people. It's an old concept, but you know, we kind of like the idea of self-government, being in charge of our own future. A lot of people have been very angry about the fact that, hey, who does this government serve? And in terms of our private lives, boy, it's big now in terms of who, whether or not people are going to have equal rights. It used to be that, just a few years ago, not even liberal Democrats would say they were for marriage equality, gay marriage, so to speak. And now there's just this tremendous sea change of public opinion. Although I read today Supreme Court Justice Scalia said, what big sea change? There's only 9 states now that allow marriage equality. So I don't think he's going to be a vote. But the issue is before the United States Supreme Court now. They have taken it, and it's a little bit confusing because there's 2 cases before the Supreme Court, both of which have to do with marriage equality. And here to explain it all to you, Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst for American Progress, where his work focuses on the Constitution and the judiciary. Thanks for being with us, Ian, on the Burt Cohen Show. And there are 2 cases that the Supreme Court is hearing on marriage equality. I wonder if you could just describe them so that we can have a clear sense of what they are. Could you just start out by describing the 2 cases that the Supreme Court is hearing? What's the difference between the two? What are the significance of the two?
Sure thing. So the case that was heard yesterday dealt with the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, which says that same-sex married couples are not entitled to the federal rights that come along with being married, and there are a lot of them. You could, there are certain tax benefits, there are Medicare benefits, there are Social Security benefits, there are a lot of benefits for members of the military who are married, and if you are gay and you are married, you do not get any of those benefits under DOMA. The case that was heard the day before dealt with California's Proposition 8, which said that California will not marry same-sex couples. And the question there is whether California should be required to comply with the Constitution and marry same-sex couples, but potentially also whether other states should have to comply. There's potential going into that case that we could see marriage equality in all 50 states, although after the argument, I think that that outcome is unlikely.
Wow, interesting. And it is complicated. Which was the case where there was a woman, I believe she's 84 years old now, and she's been with the same marriage partner for many years. And because it was of the same gender, she couldn't, she had to pay taxes, I guess, on the other person's death. And if it had been a spouse of a different gender, she wouldn't have to. Is that the DOMA case, or is that the Proposition 8 case?
That's the DOMA case. The woman you're referring to, her name's Edie Windsor, and her life story just exposes the ridiculousness of these laws. You know, here you have a woman who spent decades with a single committed partner. They lived together. They loved each other just as intensely as any other married couple. And then she finds out after her wife dies that she's going to have to pay these additional taxes because the federal government doesn't think that her marriage is good enough. And the issue in this case is whether the love that she felt for her wife is entitled to the same dignity as the love that anyone else feels for their wife. It's a big reason why I think we need to see DOMA go down.
And what different ways do you think the court could rule? Let's start with DOMA.
Sure thing. So on DOMA, the short answer is I think it's more likely than not that DOMA is going down, but we're not going to get a very coherent decision from the justices. There are at least three that we are certain are going to vote to uphold DOMA. They were, you know, they left no doubt about their anti-gay sentiments. There are five justices who probably will vote to strike down DOMA, but only four for the right reason. There are four justices who seem, you know, to understand that the Constitution says that you can't discriminate. It says that everyone's entitled to the equal protection of the law, and that includes gay people too. And then Justice Kennedy was very bought into this weird states' rights theory, this idea that only the states are allowed to pass laws that deal with the issue of marriage at all. He's wrong about that. But the punchline is that you can wind up with the four justices saying one thing that's correct, Justice Kennedy going off on his weird tear, and that adds up to five, so DOMA goes down. But you don't have a single opinion that carries precedential value and that can be used in the next gay rights case to advance the ball even further.
We are talking about the status before the Supreme Court right now when it comes to marriage equality. You referred to something about the Alabama question in your article. What is the Alabama question? I mean, to me, Alabama is a different nation entirely.
Well, the problem that I think a lot of the justices were wrestling with is I think there probably are five votes on the court right now who think that California should have to marry folks. And there are probably five justices who think that the federal government needs to recognize marriages when a couple is legally married under state law. I don't think that there are five votes right now, I don't even know if there's one vote right now, who's ready to say that Alabama needs to start issuing marriage licenses. You know, they think that would be too much too far at this time. And so what you saw at these arguments is the justices struggling for ways Justice Sotomayor, who may be the most liberal member of the court right now, kept asking, is there a way we can limit this to California? Is there a way we can limit this to the federal government? And I think that Sotomayor eventually wants to say that Alabama has to follow the Constitution, but I don't think they're ready to do it in this case.
Well, that could be one way to push them back to secession, which isn't necessarily a bad idea. They seriously felt like the North came in with its values back in the 1860s, and they didn't like that. They didn't want those values being put on them. Is there a chance that—so it could be perhaps—let me see if I'm right here— that California has to overturn Proposition 8 and recognize marriages, but— is there a chance that it could only apply to California, do you think?
So it's not clear what they're going to do with Proposition 8. I think the most likely outcome is no one had a good answer to the Alabama question. No one had a good answer how you can limit this to just California and not Alabama. And so what the justices seemed to be looking to do was to try to get rid of the case. And there's different ways that they could do it. One way that they would do it would just leave the lower court's decision, the Ninth Circuit's decision, in place, and that decision struck down Prop 8. So then Prop 8 is gone, but the Ninth Circuit's opinion wouldn't really govern any other states. So it was a very narrow reasoning.
That would seem to be the path of least resistance for the court.
Yeah, that's what Justice Kennedy wanted to do. The other possibility is they could say that it's slightly different, but it's one of those legal distinctions that matter, that they do not have jurisdiction over the case. And if they do that, it can lead to chaos, because there's all these difficult legal questions about how much power the lower courts had, whether they're allowed to tell the entire state of California to start marrying people or just the people who were suing them in court. And there's going to be more legal wrangling if they dismiss it on jurisdictional grounds. The good news is that I think that both the governor and the attorney general of California are going to be eager to read the district court decision broadly, and will be inclined to say that, well, we brought this to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said they didn't want to decide it. We're now still bound by this lower court order. No more Prop 8.
And there, on both of these, the expectation is that they would rule sometime in early June. Is that right?
Probably in late June, actually. I imagine normally the Supreme Court finishes up its cases at the end of June, and normally the most hotly contested cases and the most politically charged cases are put off until the last day.
Uh-huh.
I think it's going to be one of those.
So they can hightail it out of town, right? We're talking with Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst for American Progress, where his work focuses on the Constitution and judiciary. And one thing I have wondered, I know the Constitution a little bit. I'm certainly no constitutional expert. And I just wonder, under what strictly constitutional grounds any justice could say, no, gay people don't have the same constitutional rights. Do you have any guess what constitutional aspect they could cite?
I mean, there's two arguments for it. I mean, there are some people who just think that the courts should be restrained and that, generally we should leave things up to the legislative branch and the courts shouldn't do much at all. And I'm sometimes sympathetic to that. I mean, judges aren't elected, and they should be cautious when they act. But caution doesn't mean they should abdicate. The issue here is, the way that judges are limited is they have to follow the text of the Constitution. They're not allowed to just make up rights that don't exist. They're not allowed to come up with ways to strike down laws that no one had ever heard of before Barack Obama signed the health care law.
Right.
But where the Constitution is clear, they need to follow it.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And here we have a Constitution that says that no person can be denied the equal protection of the law. That means gay people too.
I cannot imagine any other interpretation that there could possibly be. And you refer to this court as a, quote, severely conservative court. That's being polite, I think, where equality could lose. How could that happen?
Well, I mean, we have four justices on this court who have consistently voted against gay rights. I mean, even in... We have two justices who are relatively new, but they've made a lot of anti-gay statements. We have two more justices who, even in the Lawrence case, the case where the issue is whether the government can throw you in jail for having sex with someone. Right. That was the issue in that case, consensual sex between two gay men. Right. And there's two justices still on the court who said, yeah, the government can throw people in jail for that. So you have some justices who have some seriously out of the mainstream views.
Yeah.
Justice Kennedy, who has been good on gay rights in the past, hasn't been perfect on gay rights in the past. He upheld the Boy Scouts policy, said the Boy Scouts were immune to an anti-discrimination law, which wouldn't allow them to discriminate against gay scouts and gay scoutmasters. So, I think there's probably five votes on the court to at least advance the ball some on gay rights. But, you know, there are a lot of really conservative people on this court. There are a lot of older people on this court. And what you see in the polls is that younger people tend to be more sympathetic to gay rights.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I don't think we should have rose-colored glasses. This is not a good court, and they may not do the right thing.
Fascinating. There is the enigma known as Justice Clarence Thomas, the quiet one, who is always determined to shrink federal power. Mm-hmm. If that's the precedent and that's his concern, might that not be a good vote?
I mean, that's the weird thing about Thomas in this case, is that Thomas, I think, actually could be the sixth vote to strike down DOMA. Thomas is very, very conservative, but from what I understand, he doesn't bear any personal animus towards gay people. He does really, really care about very radical views of states' rights. And so the good news is that it's reasonably likely, you know, at least possible, that Thomas thinks that DOMA is unconstitutional. The bad news is that Thomas also thinks that federal child labor laws and the minimum wage and the ban on whites-only lunch counters are unconstitutional. So I don't think we want to live in Thomas's world, but in a world where the federal government can do nothing, it also means that, like, I guess they can't pass DOMA either.
Well, and his... you know, in keeping with what we described, Thomas, the Proposition 8, the California thing, he might just, would it be consistent to, you know, have the Supreme Court pass on Prop 8 and let the lower courts stand?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that on Prop 8, Thomas will vote with the most conservative justices. He is not sympathetic to arguments that the Constitution protects an individual right that, either whether it's an equality right or some sort of, you know, dignity right through the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. Mm. Thomas just hasn't been sympathetic to those arguments in the past. So on Prop 8, I think he's lost. It is possible we will get him on DOMA. The problem is that if we get him on DOMA, we're not going to like the way that he does it.
I'm sure he has a unique capacity to do that. And Roberts and Alito, no chance, I presume.
No chance. I mean, one of the things I found so shocking is, like, you know, in case anyone still had illusions after he voted on the healthcare case that, oh, maybe he's moderate.
Right.
The words that were coming out of the man's mouth, I mean, you couldn't tell the difference between John Roberts and Rick Santorum.
I mean,
throwing out all this stuff about, like, oh, they're redefining marriage. At one point, he claimed that gay people are too powerful to have equal rights. You know, try to get your head around that one for a second. So, I mean,
that's
it was really weird. Distressing.
I still, as an aside, cannot believe the Democrats allowed Roberts and Alito to get on the court without saying anything. They just rolled over and played dead. Most people, Ian, would be stunned by Antonin Scalia's attitude on homosexuality. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, Scalia, you know, I wrote a piece, I think it was called The 13 Most Offensive Things That Scalia Has Compared to Homosexuality, and there's a lot of just shocking stuff on there. I mean, you know, why can't we ban sex between two consenting adults? We can ban murder as if they're the same thing. You know, and you know, it's all the things you'd expect from someone who holds his views, incest and polygamy, you know, all these terrible comparisons. But the one that, you know, actually I found the most offensive is much more subtle. He has this line in one of his opinions where he suggests that gay people are no different than, you know, a gay couple is no different than roommates, just two roommates living together. And I read that, I was like, you know, wow, dude, you really don't get this.
Well, there's a lot of straight couples that are like that too, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But they are married. They have the same rights, and it comes to questions like Social Security, various different issues that really do affect people's lives. And, the Supreme Court, when it was set up by the founders of this country, it was supposed to be beyond politics. They were appointed for life. The political landscape right now is dramatically different from just a few years ago. There's been tremendous movement toward anti-discrimination. Are they affected by politics, do you think? I mean, you've had a chance to look at the court for a lot of different issues. What do you think? Are they going to put politics aside and just do their job, which is to maintain and protect the Constitution of the United States?
Well, I mean, I think some of them are motivated by politics. I mean, I think that it's not a coincidence that this case is being brought in 2013 and not in 1996, when you had the very first positive gay rights decision out of the Supreme Court. So I think that, certainly some of them are motivated by politics. But, you know, the fact, to a certain extent, I just think that politics work against us here, if anything. There was this exchange in the Prop 8 case about when it became unconstitutional to discriminate against gay people. You know, Scalia was very upset over this question, you know, kept asking, what was the date? And the answer to that is the date that the 14th Amendment was ratified, which says that we have that there is an equal protection right in this country. You know, the minute those words came in there was the minute that this became unconstitutional. And the problem is, because of the political reasons that people didn't like gay people, it's taking us this long to figure it out. So, you know, if politics are the problem is that there has been political animus against gay people for the 150 years after those words were written into the Constitution, and it's taking us this long to figure out, oh, we actually have to follow what this document says.
I wonder, God, that is amazing to me, really, that they don't have anything to worry about. They don't have to get reelected. They don't, you know, have to raise, you know, millions of dollars to get reelected. Their job is to, protect and defend the Constitution. However, they were picked by the various presidents for a certain reason. Clarence Thomas was picked for his reasons, obviously, I guess. There's all reasons, and it's not generally by the president because they think they're going to just objectively protect the Constitution. I guess you can't humans can't really be objective. So let's look at what the likely outcome. Well, before I do that, actually, the states' rights issue that has come up a few times. I wonder how that will play into it, and certainly some of the justices do care more about the old-fashioned notion of states' rights than others. How does that play out? And I think we talked a little bit about the Alabama case.
Right. I mean, I think that the states' rights issue seems to be what's going to get Kennedy, if he votes to strike down DOMA, to vote to strike down DOMA. And there's a lot of actually frightening implications about his theory. The good news is I'd be very surprised if he gets four other people to join him on his theory. But Kennedy's view is that, so I mean, I guess you have to first understand how DOMA works. Like, most of what DOMA does is it's a statute that just defines who gets certain tax benefits and who gets certain, like, veterans benefits, Social Security benefits, and Medicare benefits. If you're a married couple and the federal government recognizes your marriage, there's certain benefits you get. And, like, obviously the federal government has the power, because they have the power to tax people and because they have the power to spend money, to figure, to say who pays those taxes and who that money will be spent on.
Right.
So, like, there isn't a state's rights issue here. The state's rights question is people claiming the federal government doesn't have the power to say who pays taxes. And that's not correct.
No, that's not correct.
What the federal government doesn't have the power to do is they don't have the power to say black people pay taxes and white people don't. They don't have the power to say women pay taxes and men don't. And they don't have the power to say gay couples are treated differently for purposes of our taxes and our federal benefits than straight couples are. You know, that's what equal protection means. It's that there are certain kinds of discrimination that you just don't get to do. And so, you know, as I said before, Kennedy's likely to say that this law is unconstitutional, but he's going to do it for the wrong reason. You know, the reason why this law is unconstitutional is because you're just not allowed to treat gay people and straight people differently under the law.
So if it sounds like, you know, if your logic carries through, then DOMA is gone. What happens? What does it look like? What does it mean to average people if DOMA is gone? Does that mean that every state now has to recognize gay marriage? I don't think it does, but see if you can explain it, please.
Well, it means two things. I mean, the first thing that it means is that if a couple is lawfully married, whether gay or straight, under their state's law, then they are entitled to be recognized by the federal government as a married couple.
Uh-huh.
So if a man marries a man in Massachusetts, they will receive all the federal rights that any other married couple receives.
They probably wouldn't want to go to Alabama, though, I must say.
Well, and that's the difficult question, is, like, the question that we are not sure about is what happens to the couple that does move from Massachusetts to Alabama, and suddenly they're living in a state that doesn't recognize their marriage.
Right.
I mean, I think the answer is that if you've been married in any state, the federal government has to recognize it, because that's how they generally treat marriage.
The federal government does, but...
Right. And so, you know, Alabama might not recognize this couple's marriage, but Massachusetts will.
Right.
And I think if there's a gay couple living in Alabama and they want to get their federal benefits, they should be able to take a trip to Massachusetts and get married there. But those, I think, are going to be open questions. And if it's just DOMA that's struck down, I think, like, that's what the next fight is going to be, is making sure that couple in Alabama, even if Alabama won't recognize their rights, at least receive the federal benefits that they are entitled to under law.
So it won't be over. Now, it seems like the conventional wisdom is that the Supreme Court might just pass on Prop 8 and let the lower court ruling stand. So what does that mean for the average person who may not live in California?
I mean, the short answer is that if you don't live in California, it probably has no implications for you.
Right.
You know, the most likely outcome in the Prop 8 case is going to be some sort of result that'll probably only impact the state of California. You know, it's possible that, like, a few other states might have some limits where they won't be able to repeal marriage equality if they've already enacted it. But the most likely impact from the Prop 8 case, if you don't live in California, is going to be nothing.
Interesting. Well, there's a lot of, you know, all over the Facebook, people are having those equal signs, and there's a lot of activity. I don't know if it means anything. I mean, the U.S. senators are coming around on it. That's obviously separate. I wonder if there is an opportunity, a way people can plug in and help make it happen. I mean, the U.S. Senate can't do anything about it, can they?
Well, I mean, yeah, what they could do is they could repeal DOMA.
That would be good.
And I mean, part of the problem that we have is, you know, President Obama ran on a pretty aggressive gay rights stance, and he won.
Yes.
And the Democrats had a really difficult map. If you look at the number of, like, Republicans who are running for election versus the number of Democrats who are running for election in the Senate in 2012, it was not the sort, you know, everyone was predicting that the Democrats were going to lose seats. And in this year where they were the party associated with gay rights, they won in this very difficult map. They actually picked up seats. And if you go over to the House side, there were actually more votes cast for Democratic members of the House than there were for Republican members of the House. But because of gerrymandering and some other factors, the party that got less votes is actually in control of the House right now.
Yeah.
So the American people, like, between two agendas, one that is very open to gay rights and one that is very hostile to gay rights, chose, you know, throughout our government, including the House, to have the side that is open to gay rights be in charge. And that's why I find it very puzzling when I hear opponents of marriage equality say, oh, we have to just let the political process play out, and the court shouldn't be stepping in. It doesn't matter what the Constitution says. Yeah. You know, we just need to give this a political process, because something's broken in our political process right now.
And the idea of having some people vote on other people's rights, I kind of got a problem with that.
Yeah.
Ian Millhiser, Senior Constitutional Policy Analyst for American Progress, where his work focuses on the Constitution and judiciary. Thank you so much. And we'll see if we can keep rocking in the free world, keep making a difference. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Shuffling their feet, people sleeping in their shoes, but there's a warning sign on the road ahead. There's a lot of people saying we'd be better off dead. Don't feel like Satan, but I am to them, so I try to forget it any way I can. Keep on rocking in the free world. 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 With a baby in a hand, under an old street light, near a garbage can. Now she put the kid away and she's gone to get a hit. She hates her life and what she's done this. That's one more kid that'll never go to school, never get to fall in love, never get to be cool. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world. Keep on rocking in the free world.